Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Pacific Thunder, the U.S. Navy's Central Pacific Campaign, August 1943 to October 1944, by Thomas McKelvey Cleaver, narrated by Tom Perkins. Foreword. Between September 1942 and September 1945, U.S. Navy aircraft carriers were in action almost daily against the Japanese Empire. Those 3 years largely defined the sweep and scope of the Pacific War, the largest theater of operations in the world's largest conflict. At 64 million square miles, the Pacific Ocean covers about one-third of the planet's surface, more than the combined total of Earth's land area. Such is the enormity of the arena in which Thomas McKelvey Cleaver sets his dramatic survey of the Pacific carrier campaigns following the arrival of the new Navy in the summer of 1943. The story begins on a downbeat for American forces with loss of the Wasp, CV-7, to an extraordinarily competent Japanese submarine captain off Guadalcanal, 9 months after the stunning attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, on December 7, 1941. Following that 20th-century version of shock and awe, the Imperial Navy rode roughshod over Allied forces across the eastern half of the Pacific, including the Chinese coast, Philippines, and Dutch East Indies. In fact, the war probably could not have been started without the six carriers that launched nearly 400 aircraft against Pearl. With her battleships destroyed or damaged, America's only resort was a handful of Pack Fleet carriers, from three at the beginning to a maximum of four during the subsequent year. The Naval Millennium arrived in May 1942 when, for the first time, two fleets fought one another beyond visual range. The carrier had displaced the battleship atop the world's naval pyramid. Following Japan's stunning reversal of fortune at Midway in June 1942, America launched its first offensive of the war at Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands in August. Two carrier battles were fought for control of the waters around Guadal, setting the stage for the inevitable voyage northward leading to Tokyo Bay itself. Yet Pacific Thunder goes beyond the battles, ships, and leaders who fought the titanic campaigns for oceanic control through 1945. Cleaver properly backtracks to describe the technical and institutional battles and innovations that produced the aircraft carrier. Both the U.S. and Japanese navies, following in Britain's wake, spent two decades perfecting equipment and techniques in carrier aviation. Such was the carrier's primacy that it enabled the Pacific island-hopping campaigns of 1943 to 1944, when the Pacific Fleet brought its own air power with amphibious forces to seize crucial bases en route to Japan itself. Operating beyond range of land-based aircraft, the fast carriers and their smaller, slower escort carrier teammates pioneered a wholly new martial art. Throughout Pacific Thunder, you will meet a democratic cast of characters in the global drama. Snipes in the engineering spaces, air crewmen as well as aviators, aces as well as admirals. Some of the stories have often been told, such as the First Battle of the Philippine Sea, better known as the Marianas Turkey Shoot. Others are rendered both in macro and micro scale, leading to the final missions over Japan itself. The facts of Cleaver's story float on this sea of memories. Few of the players remain today as time wins its inevitable victory over human beings. But thanks to Cleaver and his generation of historians, the sweeping, gripping story is being preserved. We who delve into the subject know that history has a shelf life, and we have passed the point of no return for the World War II veterans. But let listeners remember this. Pacific Thunder sets an example for current and future recorders of human events. Almost certainly there are men and women living within your reach who have stories to tell that deserve preserving. I urge you to follow Tom Cleaver's example in three simple words. Do it now. Barrett Tillman, author on Wave and Wing, the 100-year quest to perfect the aircraft carrier. Preface. Looking back, I can date my fascination with naval aviation in the Pacific War to around age 10, when I discovered my father's copy of the Life magazine's special issue, The Fighting Lady, with the magnificent photographs taken aboard Lexington, CV-16, by famed photographer Edward Steichen, director of the Naval Aviation Photographic Unit. Since then, I have been fortunate to be involved directly in naval aviation myself, where I got to know the first of many naval aviators I would meet over the decades since, who had served in the Pacific War, and whose stories I would hear firsthand. The subject has been a passion of mine ever since. The Navy I served in was far closer to that of World War II than today's. The majority of the ships in the fleet were veterans of that war, as well as all the senior petty officers I worked for, and most of the officers over the rank of commander. On a late-night watch, it wasn't hard for a young sailor to come up with a sincerely asked question that elicited a story it was impossible to forget, which is where I began my lifelong collection of those first-person accounts. When I walked the southern end of the island of Okinawa a mere 18 years after the battle, it was impossible to take a step anywhere without finding a bullet casing or other evidence of the desperate fight. There were still urban areas of Japan that had yet to be rebuilt from the fire raids, terrible sights that are impossible to forget. When I read World War II accounts of sailors and ships lacking air conditioning, dragging their thin mattresses up to one of the main decks to get some sleep and cooler tropic air, only to be awakened by a soaking as the ship sailed through a rain squall, I know personally what that was like. As one who grew up in the years following World War II, I am always surprised how little most of my fellow Americans under the age of 60 know about that epic conflict, particularly the war in the Pacific. When Americans think of the Good War, they think of D-Day and the liberation of Europe, the War of the Band of Brothers. Most Americans know nothing of the greatest naval battle in history, the battles of Leyte Gulf, which involved over 300 ships and 200,000 sailors and airmen on both sides, nor even how to pronounce it. Leyte. And they know even less about the battles across the Central Pacific over the previous year that led up to that epic confrontation. Growing up when I did, one did not need to have a formal class in the history of the war. One's father, one's uncles, the fathers of one's friends were all veterans of the war, and some were even willing to talk about their experiences. There was Victory at Sea on the television. Any Sunday when we stayed too long visiting my grandmother, and there was a possibility of not getting home by 6 p.m. to see that show, in the days before video recorders, would find me increasingly agitated until we got in the family car and were on the way home in time. The footage, Richard Rogers's music, Leonard Graves's narration were impossible to forget. When my father bought the record of the music, I played it so much he had to purchase a second copy. Many Americans today who do learn about the Pacific War turn away from it in revulsion. The mutual racially based contempt between Japanese and Americans is fearful to view nowadays. Dehumanizing the enemy to make him easier to kill is as old as humanity, but rarely was it practiced with a more depraved creativity than by both sides in the Pacific War. For the United States Navy, the Pacific War was personal. Until 1944, every man who passed through Pearl Harbor could see firsthand the aftermath of December 7, 1941, the date that will live in infamy. I have yet to meet a veteran of the Pacific War who saw those sights who did not swear to himself a personal oath of vengeance against those responsible. Such was not the case for Americans with regard to Hitler and the Nazis. No quarter was offered or taken between enemies in the Pacific. Men cheered the death of an attacking enemy when he fell. The crew of the battleship Missouri nearly mutinied when their captain decreed that the remains of the kamikaze pilot who had crashed into their ship should be treated with respect and buried at sea,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?